You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. He was rough. He was tough. And the lawman who chased Dan Seavey declared, of all the jolly pirates, Seavey is the jolliest. The story of Roaring Dan Seavey is over a century old, but it's still a great yarn. Scott Atkinson wrote about the Pirate of the Great Lakes in a recent issue of Our Detroit. Scott, just who was this jolly Great Lakes pirate?
Yeah, so Dan Seavey, I believe he was actually born in New York, but he came to the Great Lakes and he was what it sounds like. He was a pirate. He was supposedly, but as we find out in the story, it's not true, the only person officially charged with piracy. So again, that was part of the legend. Well, I think legend is the right word. He seemed to live up to everything that he did, and yet he was always just this larger-than-life figure. So
how so? Like what kind of buzz surrounded this guy?
He was a fighter. He would literally sail to other cities just to accept a challenge. This didn't make it into the story, but in one of them, he supposedly actually ended a fight by killing a guy by turning a piano over on him after they had destroyed the entire bar. One of the more famous ones is he accepted a challenge from a smaller guy, who was actually a professional boxer, and that was one of the few fights he lost.
He did lose that one.
But he was just an interesting guy. I mean, he did have some legal operations, but he didn't seem to care where that legal line was drawn. What I loved about this was, you know, the Great Lakes booty was not, you know, gold and silver. It was timber or illegal venison. That was one of his things. He would go up to these lakes and poach and sell deer meat.
What a character. So what happened the night of June 11th, 1908? Because that's the night this story really began.
So there are a lot of Seavey stories. And I was looking for them. I found a great book by Richard J. Boyd that gives a extremely comprehensive, very well-researched account of his entire life. And I'm just thinking, how am I going to, you know, fit this into 3,000 words? And my favorite Seavey story was, it's really the night he becomes Michigan's best-known pirate. It's unclear, but it sounds like he is working as a sailor for the crew of the Nellie Johnson under a guy named Captain McCormick. As I say in the article, he was a fierce fighter, but he was a fiercer drinker. And the way he got away with a boat was they went to a saloon in Grand Haven, and he drank them under the table until they could not stand. He was the only one that was functional. And with two of his henchmen, as I think Boyd puts it, he takes off with the Nellie Johnson, which is full of cedar posts, which is, you know, good saleable cargo. And he heads for Chicago. And from then ensues a chase all around Great Lakes, Michigan, that ends with, you know, sort of an epic climactic end in Northern Lake, Michigan. And then he's hauled back to Chicago to face the charges.
Because he couldn't sell the cargo, right?
He
thought he was
going
to sell it and make money.
Yeah, well, that's the great turning point. You know, he goes down there, he can't sell it. So now you've got a stolen ship full of stolen cargo. And what do you do from there?
And he had someone hard on his heels. Actually, a couple of men tasked with capturing him as Captain Preston Uberoth and Deputy Marshal Thomas Currier. And they were playing this, you described this really interesting cat and mouse game.
Yeah, I mean, so as a narrative nonfiction writer, like, you can't make this stuff up. And it was just pure gold. So Preston Uberoth was this guy. I mean, you can find him in old newspapers everywhere. And he was just sort of this, like, this Boy Scout. You know, there was an article written about him on the Atlantic when he was, you know, still pretty young in the Coast Guard. And he was one of a few crew who goes out, like, in this icy storm, like, rowing this boat to save this crew. When his wife died, he was, I can't remember where he was stationed, but he was somewhere far across the country. And all these newspapers pick up the story of him, you know, rushing home. Captain Uberoth rushes home to beat his wife's bedside. He was just this guy that just seems like this perfect captain, right? And then you have Captain McCormick, who wakes up one morning, presumably very hungover and with a missing boat. And apparently it took a couple of days to get the authorities on the trail because nobody believed him.
Because he was probably so hungover.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, this is not a guy you might want to believe. And so so he gets on the USS Tuscarora with Captain Uberoth, who at this point was stationed on Lake Michigan. And at first they didn't know where to look. And bit by bit, they just start going up the coast looking for Dan Seavey. But Seavey is a guy who's been sailing these waters since forever. So he knows, like, the inlets and the coves to go into and where to hide. And
the way you describe it, it's like a duel between technology and this Laker man with incredible Great Lakes know-how.
Well, I'm really glad you picked up on that, because I started thinking about it. Like, yeah, Seavey's in a sailboat, you know, an old schooner, two sails, and it's just him in the wind, which to me is just very piratey. Again,
very piratey.
The more I researched, I was like, you got to be kidding me. This is just great. And then you've got Captain Uberoth, who's on the steamship, which at one point they have it steaming so hard, the paint is burning off the smokestacks.
Full speed ahead
until they finally get him.
They chased around. Finally, what happened? How was he captured?
Okay, so they're heading up the coast, and I'm not sure where it's at. McCormick gets impatient. He gets off at some port and takes a train back home where he's pretty sure Dan Seavey is Uber off the Stonewall's boat heading north. They do find the boat that he stole, the Nellie Johnson, but they find it in a cove somewhere, you know, with 6 feet of water in its hold. The timber's still there. So he finds a place to sink the boat and then takes off.
Gives up on the timber he can't sell just to get away.
And so they try to plan it strategically. They head out early the next morning, I believe. And there on the horizon is Dan Seavey back in his own boat, the Wanderer. This is where the details get hazy because the newspapers at the time, I mean, they had more fun with this than I did, right? And so there, it was really tough to see where the myth ended and the truth began, or vice versa. According to some accounts, you know, Seavey's still he's heading for one of two islands where he had like these secret hideouts where he was poaching, which again is just wonderful, and on northern Lake Michigan. And so according to some reports, they actually fired a cannon shot over the top of his boat, and that was when he finally said, "Okay, I give up." According to other accounts, that's just myth. I don't know. But to me, that was actually, at first, as a reporter, it's the kind of thing you run into and you're like, what's the story? I don't know. But then I realized after a time, well, that is the story because pirates are the stuff of legends.
And
so the fact that was he really charged with piracy? Probably not. Did they really fire the shot? Probably not. But the fact that he became this, you know, because we wanted that.
The way you end your story was stunning to me about when he was, quote, brought to justice. What, he wandered back to New Haven with a smile and a new suit?
He walked free. Yeah, and it seems really unclear. I mean, Richard J. Boyd researched that very thoroughly. He found a lot of the documents, you know, of those courts. But even to him, it was very unclear. Like, there was something happened behind closed doors where I don't think he spent a day in jail. He walked free.
But he, as far as you know, is the first to have been charged with piracy in the Great Lakes?
It doesn't look like he actually was.
Charged.
But, I mean, he became known for that.
Yeah.
Right? And so, I mean, if you do some Googling around for Great Lakes pirates, more than one name pops up, but none more often than Dan Seavey.
And how did his final years spin out?
So he died in Wisconsin. Actually, my original goal for the story, because I'm not the first guy to write about him, right? You can find him, especially in a lot of the anthologies about, you know, the cutthroats of the Great Lakes and things, and he's in all of those. And so what I wanted to write about are his final days. He ends up in Wisconsin. He dies very poor, survived by at least one daughter. I think he died it was in the 50s, I think, in a nursing home. Mm-hmm. And so for this guy who lived this uproarious life, then that's the end he came to. And apparently, I think he became very religious in his final days. And so the story I really wanted to search for are the final days of Dan Seavey.
The story you tell us in Our Detroit is a rollicking good story. Why do you think we're so enchanted by pirates?
I think it's the mythology of it. Like I say in the story, you know, and it's actually like that last paragraph you talk about, my wife called me out. I'm like, you got to read this. And she's like, so he beat up people and he stole from people. And I said, well, if you want to say it that way, like, you're absolutely correct. But I think we're attached to the myth. We associate pirates, I think, with a free life, with that Johnny Depp-like character who's, you know, sailing the seas, attached to nothing, doing whatever they want, taking whatever they want. And I think that was the way Seavey really tried to live his life. Like I said, he had some ventures that were legal, some that weren't. I think he simply, it wasn't that he was doing things illegally on purpose. He simply didn't care.
There you go. Scott Atkinson wrote about Roaring Dan Seavey, the pirate of the Great Lakes, in a recent issue of Our Detroit. And once again, that quote says it all. Of all the jolly pirates, Seavey is the jolliest. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks.